my privilege today to introduce a friend. And most of you in the audience probably know him better than you do me. Todd Compton will be presenting today on something that's vitally important. He is the author of several books that have to do directly with the topic today. I have brought the one about in sacred loneliness, which is the book to read for the poor old wives of Joseph Smith. The other one that has some bearing today is his editing of the diaries of Helen Mar Kimball. She was the youngest wife of Joseph Smith in what would only be described as an arranged marriage. She was 14 at the time. And Todd will talk about how aware she may or may not have been of the fact that this was actually a real marriage she was going into. There were other marriages of girls even younger than Helen Mar Kimball in that time frame. When we hear about the FLDS last year and their arranged young marriages, those of us who have read on Mormon polygamy could only say, we've seen this before. But the FLDS were doing it in today's culture, where indeed it would be considered, at least in America, reprehensible. The question is, what was the norm in 1830 and 1840 Midwest America? Was this different? Was 12 and 14-year-old marriages, were they normal? What was the? What are we looking for here? As an historian, and Todd and I have discussed this before, we think it's vital to understand the context of the history we're writing about. Mormons were not alone in Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, in the 1830s and 1840s. There was a culture going on around them. And Todd today will talk and tell us about that culture, and particularly about the polygamy part of that culture. This is not going to be a presentation. I'm not the respondent, but Todd always invites questions and leaves lots of answers at time at the end for questions. He's extremely knowledgeable. He and I have talked many hours on related topics to this in 1930s Missouri, where I've spent a lot of time researching. Without further ado, he's also the father of two lovely children, the husband of Laura, who will also be part of a panel with my wife and do several other things in this. And I had the opportunity of knowing both of them before they knew each other. Mr. Compton?
Hey, if we have latecomers, there's a couple answers here.
And there's no... I guess we're just supposed to stand close to that. Okay. I have a long paper here that I will edit as I read along. So bear with me. The raid on the FLDS compound in Texas that took place in April 2008 has brought polygamy to national attention recently, since the FLDS Church is a breakoff of the Mormon Church. This has inevitably led the media to look at polygamy in 19th century Mormonism to give context for the modern practice. And because the raid was spurred by reports of marriages involving underage teenage girls, the question of whether this aspect of FLDS polygamy has roots in 19th century Mormon polygamy has arisen. And incidentally, historians of family life call the practice of teenagers marrying early marriage, a term I will use in this article. I will refer to the marriage of girls at ages 14 and 15 as very early marriage. And I'm kind of following a historian of a family history in that way. He actually calls marriages of girls at 14, 15, he calls them child marriage. I'll use very early marriage. In April 2008, Timothy Egan wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that explicitly found the roots of questionable FLDS practices in Orthodox Mormon polygamy in the 1800s. Many conservative Mormons have strongly denied this, though they do not deny that the 19th century Latter-day Saints, including founding prophet Joseph Smith, often married teenagers as plural wives. However, Mormon conservatives have stated that young women marrying very early was an accepted part of the culture at the time. Among them is my friend, historian Craig Foster, who published an article on the subject in Farm's Review of Books. LDS Church historian Marlon Jensen also wrote a reply to Egan that appeared on the LDS Church's official website. And General Authority Todd Christofferson has also defended Mormon polygamists of the previous century in an interview. Conservatives have had the tendency to make statements like the following. Marriages of young girls were not uncommon in the past, as Foster writes. It seems to me that there are two problems with this kind of statement. First, it is so general that it doesn't help much. In Foster's statement, not uncommon and the past are very broad, vague terms. If you say that marriages at an early age were common, quote, common, what does common mean? 10% of marriages? 5%? 2%? So it would be better to progress from broad generalizations to some kind of specificity in time and place. And in different places and times, percentages will vary a great deal. Second, often the evidence for such statements comes from cultures very different from 19th century New England America, which is the cultural background for Mormonism. The fact that colonists in 17th century Quebec or gypsies in 18th century Serbia arranged marriages for their children in the early teens is not evidence needed to examine 19th century American marriage practice. So if you're going to argue that early marriage was common in Joseph Smith's environment, you need to produce statistical evidence that it was common in 19th century New England culture. The data from exotic cultures may be interesting and worth discussing, but they are not directly relevant to 19th century American culture. Third, conservatives have sometimes argued from a legal basis, for instance, stating that the age of consent for young women was 12 in such and such countries and states at such and such times. If early marriage was legal, yet was extremely rare, the legal data, while interesting, is not directly relevant. Therefore, let's frame the question in this way. Of Joseph Smith's 33 plural marriages that can be reliably documented, in my view, 10 were marriages to teenage girls, including a marriage to 14-year-old Helen Mark Kimball, daughter of Apostle Heber C. Kimball. Were such early marriage ages typical for 19th century New England culture? I am not a social historian specializing in the family, but I will refer to the work of respected social historians of America who do answer this question. Often their conclusions derive from hard data statistics. Again, I'm not a statistician, but will try to reflect their conclusions accurately. And I'm aware of the value and limitations of statistical evidence. So this is the place for my statistics joke. A statistician, a historian, and an economist went duck hunting. So when the duck flies by, the historian shoots at it and shoots 10 feet above it. The economist shoots 10 feet below it. And the statistician says, "Got him." I guess the point of that story is you can use statistics to come at some, you know, to arrive at something totally false. So also statistics can be slightly misleading if you're not a statistician itself, if you don't know how to interpret them. The authors I looked at often use the term mean, okay, and which has been defined as the sum of the observations divided by the number of observations. But sometimes that mean doesn't reflect important evidence. For instance, if a polygamist married women at the ages of 17, 18, 19, 22, and 65, which happened in Mormon polygamy, the mean marriage age, 28.2, is skewed by the 65-year-old outlier. Okay, and so most of his marriages were, you know, in the teens, but if you say the mean marriage age is 28.2, it sounds like he married a lot of women, you know, 25, 26, 28. Sometimes authors refer to the median, which selects the center age in the data group. That has other problems. Okay, sometimes the author provides standard deviation figures for the mean, which helps you understand the spread of the data better. So mean age of marriage, I think one thing we have to keep in mind is the lower age for marriage for women, which is mostly what we're going to be talking about here, at first marriage, is, you know, it kind of starts around 14. That's the lower end. And usually it doesn't go much beyond, you know, 20s, middle 20s, late 20s, for most of these marriages we're talking about. Okay. Okay, just a few principles from the history of marriage throughout world history. Okay, one factor that has caused early marriage was the tendency for marriages to be used to create political or dynastic bonds. Okay, so a powerful politician in Rome will marry off his 12-year-old daughter, you know, to another powerful politician to seal the two families together. And one historian, Stephanie Kuntz, in her book, Marriage, A History from Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage, has argued that it wasn't until the end of the 1700s that marriage came to be seen as a private relationship between two individuals, rather than one link in a larger system of political and economic alliances. And I like a title in one of the chapters of her books, Playing the Bishop, Capturing the Queen, Aristocratic Marriages in Early Medieval Europe. Marriage was part of the chess game of power politics. Okay, economics was also an important factor affecting marriage age, as young people often delayed marriage until they had achieved financial stability. So a bad economy at a certain time or place could cause marriages that were relatively late. And this highlights another difference between elite and non-elite marriages. For elites, generally well-to-do, were financially able to marry earlier. And also, there's a difference between the dynastic marriages for elite and non-elite, because the non-elite, you know, were not trying to seal political or economic bonds between families. Okay. The classic... Oh, and sometimes another cause of early marriage is colonization. In other words, if you send a... Often when you started a colony, you sent a bunch of men to the colony. And then all of a sudden they woke up and realized, hey, we don't have any women here. So in one famous example, in colonial Quebec, France just sent a whole bunch of young women over to the colony. And so let's see, in the mid-17th century, some 220 young women, many teens, were shipped to Canada because of the great preponderance of men in the early colony. However, a historian notes, only the first wave of French Canadian wives were so young. So in colonies, after the first period of imbalance, which drives the marriage age down, especially among young women, then the marriage age gradually creeps up till it's normal. In the ancient world and in non-Western cultures, you can find many examples of early marriage. Family historians talk about the European pattern of marriage age, though, which can be summed up succinctly. Europeans married later than non-Europeans. And England, of course, is in the European pattern. In the European pattern, on the average, men tended to marry in their late 20s and women in their early or mid-20s. Non-Europeans married much earlier. Okay, in Great Britain at the end of the 19th century, 73% of women were single at age 20 to 24, and 42% were single at age 25 to 29. So that's the European pattern. For some really bizarre examples of young child marriage, in one province at a certain time, the average age of marriage was 13. And sometimes older men married literal children, you know, like 5, 6 years old. And because you have older men marrying these younger children, sometimes the men would die and leave the children widows, you know, at age 5 or 6. And marriage age authority Thomas Monahan writes, in one province, 10% of the females under 5 years of age are widows, and over 50% of those under 15 years of age are widows. Isn't that amazing? And since there was a prohibition on widows remarrying in this culture, those girls and young women were prohibited from normal marriages in their later life. Okay, but that's an example of non-European pattern. Okay.
Where was that?
This is India. I don't have the exact provinces, but if we check Monahan's book, we can find it. Okay, now I turn to New England colonial America. Okay, and so naturally, it's a colony, so we have the pattern of there's kind of an imbalance of men toward the beginning, and so you have lower ages for women, and they gradually rise. Okay, so if you want to look at my, I'll kind of summarize this section, but my handout is totally about that. Okay. And another thing, one thing that helped in America, helped early marriages, was there was more economic opportunity. In England, a young man might say, I've got to delay marriage till I'm 29 because I don't have my own farm hold or whatever. In America, a young man could just go out and start a farm. And so that would drive the marriage age down a little bit. So American marriage ages were always a little bit below England, the pattern in England. Now, early social histories of colonial America, working from literary references, assumed that Americans married much younger than did the English. For example, Arthur Calhoun wrote, "The early Puritans married young. Girls often married at 16 or under. Old maids were ridiculed or even despised. A woman became an ancient maid at 25." End quote. A more current social historian, Mara Spanofskis, writes, "While current analyses of adolescence almost uniformly point to the problems caused by early marriages and childbearing, these older studies suggest the opposite. Colonial Americans perceived women who did not marry in their teenage years as unfortunate and disadvantaged." However, when this new generation of statistical historians started looking at actual vital records, Vanoskis writes, "they discovered to everyone's surprise that few New England girls had married as early as age 15 to 16. Instead, the age of first marriage in colonial New England showed that women typically married in their very early 20s and men married during their late 20s. Okay, so we can just look at some of these figures here and look at that table 3-1. This is from Mara Spanofskis' book. I don't have it, but you should have it here. That's Spanofskis, Fertility in Massachusetts. And you can see that the early marriage ages, like, say, Andover, Massachusetts, first generation, 19 was the mean age for women. But then you get to the fourth generation, it's 23, okay, which is closer to the European pattern. On the other side of the page, first marriages in Plymouth Colony, mean age of women at time of first marriage, and you see it started, he didn't have dates for before 1600, but 1600, 1825. Mean age of marriage was 20.6, and his last generation, 1675 to 1700, 22.3. Okay, so this is the colonial pattern. You start earlier, and you work your way up. But notice that even the earliest, they're only about 20.6. Okay, and that's in a frontier situation where there's that early imbalance of men. Okay, and incidentally, marriage ages in the southern colonies were lower than New England, but my focus here is on New England, which is the background of Mormonism. Okay, so these are colonial data, but our target time period is later, the time of Mormon polygamy. And Thomas Patrick Monahan has made marriage age his specialty and has authored a 2-volume work titled The Pattern of Age at Marriage in the United States. According to Monahan, the mean age of marriage in 1845 Massachusetts was 26.1 for males and 23.9 for females. Okay, so that's the mean age of marriage. So that's fairly high. And just for comparison, in 1948, The mean age for men was 26.5, while for women it was 24.2.
Here's the question.
Yeah.
The marriages happened in Nauvoo rather than Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Is there a reason to focus on Massachusetts rather than on the frontier area itself?
Yes. New England was where the culture from which most Mormons came.
Right.
Okay.
But, I mean,
and we have data from there. We don't have data from, like, Illinois in 1840 that I know.
All right.
Okay. But, you know, the New England is the general, you know, that's the background for Mormonism. Okay. Vanoskis observes that data on 19th century marriages is scarce. So I wanted to give you this background from colonial New England, you know, just to show you the pattern there. You know, but it's interesting, 19th century data, he says, is not as plentiful. However, he researched census records, and he states that the mean age at first marriage in Massachusetts from 1845 to 1860 was about 26 for males and 24 for females. Okay. So at no time during the colonial or early national period, did large numbers of very young adolescents regularly marry in New England, he writes. Okay. So that's, there we have actually the time period of Mormon polygamy. And the mean age in Massachusetts, which is a standard New England place, 24, the age was 24, mean age of marriage at first marriage for females. Okay, my next section is called Early and Very Early Marriage. Vanoskis writes of women in the mid-19th century, only 3.6% of native-born women and 4.7% of foreign-born women, age 14 to 19, were married, illustrating the relative infrequency of marriage among teenagers in the 19th century. Okay, let me repeat that. 3.6% of native-born women, 4.7% of foreign-born women, ages 14 to 19, were married. Okay, so that's teenage marriage. And the source of his data is Massachusetts census records. Thus, only 4.7% of married women in Massachusetts at about the time of Mormon polygamy were married while teenagers. And undoubtedly, the older teenage years predominated in that 3 to 4%. Okay, so that makes it look like, you know, the very early marriage, you know, 14 and 15, is very, very rare in America, New England. And according to Monahan, very early marriages, females at the age of 15 and under and males at 17 years and under, quote, rarely exceeded 0.5 of all first marriages and more often amounted to less, end quote. Okay, in the late 1800s in Massachusetts, very early marriages of females were at 0.3 to 0.4%. Okay, so that sounds like it's very, very rare, 14 and 15. You know, you do have some examples of it, but it's quite rare. Vanoskis writes, as the 18th century progressed and the sexual imbalance corrected itself, male colonists no longer had to take a young wife. While some Americans had praised the virtues of early marriages, few of them personally followed that advice. Indeed, in the 19th century, many women increasingly felt that they should enjoy their youthful independence for as long as possible before settling down to the responsibilities of married life. The statistical numbers for early Mormon polygamy thus do not correlate with the numbers for 19th century New England. Confining our research to Joseph Smith for the time being, of his 33 plural wives, 30% were teenagers. Okay, so that compares with the 3% in Massachusetts. And two of them, 6%, were in the very early marriage category, 14 or 15, which compares with the 0.5% in Massachusetts. Okay, now I turn to early marriage in polygamous Utah. The history of Mormonism and Mormon polygamy has many examples of early marriage. It was an accepted part of Mormon culture. And in fact, statistics as well as common sense have shown that polygamy tended to cause early marriage. BYU family historian Catherine Danes has studied marriage patterns in the small town of Manti, Utah in the 19th century in her book, More Wives Than One, Transformation of the Mormon Marriage System, 1840 to 1910. And she provides statistical evidence indicating that the mean age of marriage in Utah was much lower than in New England. She divides her data, like many statisticians do, into cohorts. The first, born before 1852, the second, 1852 to 1869, third, born between 1870 and 1890. And the overall mean age of marriage for non-immigrants, people born in Utah, in the first cohort in Manti was 18.07. Okay, that's the overall mean age of marriage. Okay, and so remember some of these other figures for women, it was more like 23. Okay, immigrants had a higher age of marriage, possibly because of the European pattern. Possibly because when they immigrated, some of them were older. And so that's 18%. That includes males and females. So since males typically married a year or two below them, for Danes' first cohort, you'd expect that the mean age of marriage would be 16 to 17. That's the mean age of marriage. Danes states that this mean age for entering marriage, which she derived from Manti records, was typical of Utah, and she cites studies by Manoah Bean and Skolnick, Manoah Bean and Anderton, and by Larry Loeb for St. George to support this generalization. And in the interest of time, I have paragraphs on each of those, well, two of those. I'll read a little bit from Loeb in his book, A Sermon in the Desert, Belief and Behavior in Early St. George. And he wrote, he says, the median age of women at first marriage in St. George was 18.9. In Philadelphia at the same time, the median age was 25. One might ask, was this age of marriage simply typical of frontier culture? You know, Mormons were on the frontier in Utah. And Loeb says, no. He says, while frontier marriage ages were younger than eastern ages in other states, the marriages of residents of St. George were even younger than among the western couples shown in Table 1, without the circumstances that apparently encouraged youthful marriages on the frontier. So in other words, in other places in the frontier, often you had that typical imbalance of men, where there were more men than women, which drove the marriage age down. But in Utah, that was not typical, that imbalance of men. And if you remember, after that first pioneer group in 1847, the next pioneer group was fully, you know, lots of men, lots of women. And part of Mormon culture, you know, that you want not just men, you want men and women together. And so you didn't have that typical frontier imbalance of men and women. So Mormon colonies were not a typical frontier situation for that reason. And that was not the reason the marriage age was down. Also, Loeb says opportunities in Mormon towns were limited, which is another reason why frontier marriages, the marriage age, were down. But if you wanted, like, to stay in St. George, your economic opportunities were limited. And so the typical reasons for frontier early marriages were not there in Mormonism. Okay, what did cause these very low marriage dates in Mormonism? To return to Danes, in her first cohort, 15% of women were married between the ages of 14 to 17. Okay, that's really striking compared to the figures from back east, isn't it? At age 16, 27% of the women between ages 14 to 17 were married. In the second cohort, this percentage has decreased. 5% of women were married between the ages of 14 to 17. And as we know, during the 1856, 1857, there was a lot of pressure put on people from church leaders to marry polygamously, and that really drove the marriage age down in Utah. Okay, thus in 19th century Utah, early marriage, including very early marriage, was common. The rates of early marriage lowered in Utah as time went on, but they were always much higher than typical Eastern American early marriage rates, and even lower than frontier marriage rates in states around Utah. Compare the about 57% of Dane's second cohort who married in their teens, compared with the 3% we saw in New England setting at about the same time. That's really striking, isn't it? The analysis of Vinovskis and Gottlieb offer one important possible factor for early marriages in Utah, the frontier. Well, I talked about that already. Okay, and you don't have that imbalance in Utah normally. Okay, so what did cause the lower marriage age? Polygamy, in which men marry women, by definition causes an imbalance of the sexes. If a man marries 10 or 20 or 30 wives in a certain community, there are obviously fewer women to go around in the community, and the competition for marriageable women or young women will be all the more intense. This would serve to drive down the age of marriage for girls and women. Danes writes, "The scarcity of marriageable women resulting from so many polygamous marriages in the 1850s meant that men then sought wives among increasingly younger women." End quote. In 1857, Apostle Wilford Woodruff wrote to Apostle George A. Smith, quote, "Nearly all are trying to get wives until there is hardly a girl 14 years old in Utah but what is married or just going to be," end quote. And Dane's statistics show that Woodruff was not joking when he wrote that. And Danes writes, "The demand for plural wives continued to create a scarcity of marriageable women until the 1880s, thus depressing the age of marriage for Utah women." It was specifically polygamy that was one of the important causes of early marriage. Okay, thus in Manti, just after the Reformation in the 1850s, when a number of polygamous marriages were entered into, a really remarkable 52% of the women between ages 14 and 20 were married. And in the decades before and after the 1850s, the numbers were not as high, but still about 29% of women between 14 and 20 were married. And these figures, 29, 52, 29, present a startling contrast to that 3 or 4% we saw in New England. And I'm sure a lot of you know anecdotal stories of early marriage in Utah. And I kind of have steered away from that, you know, because I wanted to look at statistics here. But here's just one example that kind of shows the pattern we have here. Charles Rich, and by the way, I got this from George Smith's new book that we'll talk about at lunch today. Charles Rich, later an apostle, married 14-year-old Harriet Sargent on March 28, 1847. And Rich's biographer wrote that Harriet was, quote, "a beautiful young woman, fully matured," end quote, and that she was, quote, "much sought after both by married and by single men." Isn't that interesting? Here's this 14-year-old, much sought after, not just by single, but by polygamous. In 1847, March 28, 1847, which is as, I forget the exact chronology, but it's the year of the first years of crossing the plains. Not long after Nauvoo. And by the way, just like we had this big increase in polygamous marriages in the Reformation, we had another one right before people crossed the plains because they wanted to marry polygamously in the Nauvoo Temple. So that caused... pardon?
How old was Rich when that marriage took place?
He was in his 30s. He was 35 or so. I have a little bit more in my footnote. I'll read it here. Rich's five plural wives were aged 33, 15, 19, 14, and 14. While he was aged 35 to 37 when he married his plural wives. And I write here, a little snarky, I guess. "Not exactly the pattern of the bishop taking care of widows by marrying them that we like to emphasize as, you know, conservative Mormons." That pattern did take place. You know, you do have bishops marrying, you know, widows to take care of them. It's just what... If people emphasize that and exclude everything else, that's what's wrong. And it's interesting, in according to the biographer, Charles Rich, he consulted very closely with his wife when selecting his plural wives. And so I guess his wife didn't object. Did you have a question?
I was just curious if there, I don't know if the data shows this, but is there any sense that these younger brides were brides of last resort, meaning all the marriageable women had been taken up at a certain age, so you had to move down the age ladder, or were they the...
Yeah, that's what I think exactly is happening. That's what Danes, I think, is saying happened.
I'm sure if there was any group of older marriageable women that were left because of a preference for... Yeah, I don't know if there's any...
You know, that'd be interesting to go back and go to those Nauvoo wards, and, you know, and see. And but I get the impression that, you know, the older women were being married too, you know, but there was just a shortage of any women, older or younger. And so they started looking younger and younger and younger. Another example is I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. Obviously, one of the Altman and Gannett, in their book on modern polygamists, Families in Contemporary Society, it's a fine book, state that 54.9% of the women in the demographic group they studied in modern polygamists, fundamentalists, we call them, married at age 15 to 19. That's 54.9%. Okay, and so very, very different than obviously the figures back east among non-Mormons. Obviously, one of the dysfunctional aspects of such culture is it would leave many single young men without wives if the 15 or 16-year-old girls were marrying older men who already had plural families. In 19th century Mormonism, the mission field served as a place where young men could go out and find wives. And FLDS young men would not have the option in the same way. Okay.
So they would find their wives on their missions. My understanding is there was a custom of preserving some of the young ladies for the missionary that returned. That was one of the incentives to go on a mission. That they, when they came home, they would be able to find a wife. Whereas if they didn't, they would set aside for them.
I haven't run into that myself. I think that obviously if you hadn't gone on a mission, people would look at you as not as spiritual as someone who had been on a mission, and so you wouldn't be as marketable, you know, in a Mormon community. But I haven't heard of specifically setting women aside or anything like that. Dynastic marriages is a cause of early marriage, okay, which we have seen, as I mentioned, throughout history. It's been a very, very common reason for early marriage. And so Joseph Smith married teenage Helen Mark Kimball in a dynastic marriage. He was president of the church. Heber C. Kimball was an apostle. And it's very clear when you read the accounts that they wanted to link their families together in an eternal way. Because polygamy was an elite religious phenomenon in Mormonism, the higher a man rose in the hierarchy, the more he was expected to live the law of plurality. There would be a natural tendency for the elite to marry among each other by means of plural marriages. For example, Apostle Wilford Woodruff offered his 14-year-old daughter to President Brigham Young in 1857 during the Reformation. But Young said he was not marrying younger women at the time. On March 4, 1859, Phoebe Amelia Woodruff, a 17-year-old daughter of Wilford, married another apostle, Lorenzo Snow. When men married very young wives, sometimes they delayed consummation until years later. For example, on November 11, 1843, Wilford Woodruff, 46 at the time, married 15-year-old Emma Smith. However, she had no children until 7 months after she turned 19. Woodruff's biographer, Thomas Alexander, concludes, "He probably refrained from sexual relations with Emma until she became older," end quote. Another well-known example is John D. Lee's marriage to a 12-year-old, Mary Ann Williams, during the Reformation in 1856. Okay, so that really shows competition. You know, I think competition was driving the marriage down, the marriage age so far down that you even married a 12-year-old with the agreement that you wouldn't consummate it until years later. But you wanted to make sure you had that 12-year-old in your family, you know. And as it turned out, do you know this story? You know, as it turned out, she put off having relations with Lee, and then she and one of Lee's sons fell in love, and Lee released her from the marriage to him and allowed her to marry his son with his blessing. Okay, one of those interesting stories from southern Utah. But, you know, it started out with this marriage to a very young girl, where the consummation was delayed. That's the point I'm making here. And that's a common pattern in very young marriages throughout history. And Gottlieb, I left this out, but she says, often with these very young marriages throughout history, the consummation was delayed, living together was delayed, and often the marriage didn't take place. You know, because, you know, obviously that's not a way to solidify a marriage from the very beginning, is it? But, you know, later, sometimes, you know, consummation and living together came later. Yeah?
All right, just a kind of a reverse story to the one that you just told, but interesting in the dynastic sense, is in an offshoot of my family, a young man was engaged to be married to a young woman. I think she was 17 or 18, he was 19 or so. And he tragically, almost on the eve of the wedding, died from an accident. And his father said that since she was intended to be part of their family dynasty, that he would marry her, which he did. And she proceeded to bear to the father 10 or 11 children.
Where did this happen, by the way?
Interestingly, I believe it was either Arizona or New Mexico.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, we have reached my conclusions here. Thus, I don't find the arguments of conservative Mormons that early marriage was common in the past, you know, with those very general terms. I don't find those statements convincing. These terms are too general and imprecise. Also, it's easy to find exotic examples of early marriage in many cultures and countries, but the society we should be looking at is the New England culture that was the background for early Mormonism. The work of social historians allow us to say with some precision that early marriage was quite rare in that environment. In the mid-19th century, only 3 to 4% of the marriages, did young women marry in their teens in New England. The rate of early marriage in Joseph Smith's plural family and in later Mormonism was much higher than that. A much more convincing path for conservatives to follow, I think, you know, in trying to put Joseph Smith's marriage to 14-year-old Helen Mark Kimball into context, would be to emphasize that it was a dynastic marriage, a marriage arranged by elite Mormon leaders, Joseph Smith and an apostle. And Joseph Smith's plural marriages often represented dynastic marriages that linked him to other Mormon leaders, such as Brigham Young, who married her sister, Lloyd Richards, who married his sister. Since historical reality and the human soul are complex, this doesn't rule out parallel motivations for marriage. One may want to marry someone for 5 or 6 good reasons, but the dynastic motivation was present in many LDS elite marriages. As I have written elsewhere, there is no evidence at all for or against sexuality in the Joseph Smith Helen Mark Kimball marriage. But my judgment is that it is unlikely that the marriage was consummated. Once you accept this, you can draw the valid parallel from American and European history of elite early marriage that were not consummated until the marriage participants were much older. And you can also mention that pattern in Utah Mormonism. It's documented in Utah. However, you should also deal with the emotional impact of an arranged marriage on the young wife in question. Thank you. Now we're open to questions.
Did you see, you mentioned early that the Southern pattern was slightly younger than the
New England. It was younger.
Do you remember how much?
No. My impression is that it was something like a couple years younger.
Because Rich was a Southerner. Rich wasn't a New Englander.
That's interesting.
He was from the South. He also had slaves, which is another interesting part of Rich.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So, okay.
Okay. And we did have, you know, we do generalize that most Mormons came from that New England.
Yeah, by far.
And from England.
Yeah.
You know, but we did have that group of Southerners. And where was John D. Lee born? I think Kentucky, wasn't he?
Yes.
Wasn't he from Kentucky?
I think it was Illinois.
We'll have to check on that. But he had some kind of Kentucky background.
Yeah, he did.
Maybe his parents moved to Kentucky.
Yeah, they might have been of Southern background. But
we'll have to check on that. But yes.
Was there, I'm assuming there wasn't, but I'm curious, was there any kind of age of consent laws in that time that we have now that we may go with?
Okay, I mentioned that just briefly in here. That's not a subject that I researched at all for this paper, because I wanted to look at what was actually happening. You know, and you did have these ages, weird ages of consent law, like in, you know, California, the age of consent was 10 or something like that. And don't quote me on that. That's just an example. But you have these very weird low age of consent laws. You know, but I wanted to look at statistically what was actually happening. Okay, but and also, you know, the conservatives have brought that up. You know, like, oh, the age of consent was 12. You know, yes, but statistically, it was very, very uncommon for a 12-year-old to be married. So I wanted to look at it, what was actually happening. I don't like that argument, you know, the age of consent, the legal argument. Yes?
Do you know the percentage of Mormons who engage
in polygamy? Oh, that's an interesting question, and I don't have the exact figures, but you know, and it depends on how you arrange your statistics. But, you know, often people at first said something like 3%. You know, but when people began to actually do statistical research, I can barely pronounce that word, statistical. And they found it was more like, you know, 20%, 30%. And in some communities, even more. Okay, so it wasn't small.
The Manti data, she covers that in her book.
Yeah.
And in some of the southern communities, it was as high as 50%.
Yeah.
I don't remember the lows, but the lows were in Salt Lake, if I remember, at 8, 9, 10%. Mm-hmm. She covered that in her book. 2025 is the accepted norm.
But it's an adults, right?
It depends on whether you count just men.
Yeah, how you.
Because if you count women, then it gets much higher.
It's usually quoted as women living.
Well, it depends on how you.
In the homes.
Depends on how you do the statistics.
John D. Lee was born in Illinois.
John D. Lee?
According to.
Where was he raised, though? Where was he raised, though, Lori? He had some kind of Kentucky background. His parents might have moved back to Kentucky or something.
He was born in Kaskakee, Illinois.
His grandmother raised him, as I recall.
Huh. We'll have to look.
He was an anomaly, however. He's not the typical Mormon polygamist.
Or maybe I'm just thinking of that he did a mission in Kentucky or something.
Yeah, he
had a relative in Arkansas.
Yeah, and some of his wives are from Kentucky.
You just can't count. You can't take John D. Lee and stand him up as the example.
Okay, so let's stick with Rich as a Southern example.
When did the idea of the elite were the only ones chosen during Joseph Smith's time to be able to have the opportunity to go into polygamy? When did that kind of thinking end, where, you know, you just were able to have freedom without being chosen as one of the names that had dynasty, that had, you know, what England had, the thinking of marrying someone who had land, who had money, who had education. When did that stop? And
what happened in Nauvoo, and again, I recommend George Smith's book about polygamy in Nauvoo. But obviously, Joseph Smith first introduced polygamy to his close friends. And often it was Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, some of the other apostles, Orson Hyde, you know, and his close friends were often the elite. Okay, not always, but often. Okay, but polygamy became a kind of doctrine necessary for salvation in Mormonism, and so you kind of wanted to encourage everyone to be a polygamist to get the highest salvation. And so as soon as people found out about this, you know, new kind of marriage that was necessary for complete salvation, non-elites wanted to be part of it also. And so, you know, the first generation of polygamists in Nauvoo often were, you know, very elite. But, you know, when you, you know, in 1846, 1847, you get a lot of names that you've never, that I've never heard of in Mormon history that were not elite. And so they were, you know, starting back then. Now, throughout Mormon history, if you became elite, like if they called you to be a mission president or something and you were a monogamist, they would say, okay, you need to set an example. You know, you need to take a plural wife. Okay, and so if you became an elite, they would encourage you to become a polygamist. So I don't have a precise statistical answer for you, but those are some thoughts.
It was very strict as to who was elected to take on plurality.
Well, not necessarily. If you were interested in becoming a polygamist, you'd just go ask Brigham and get permission. And
no, I'm talking about before Brigham.
It was kept secret for a long time. It was not made public until after they got to Utah, it was not made public until 1851. And trying to maintain the secrecy, whether it was being done sub rosa, you know, was very critical during the Nauvoo period because they were, you know, they were already undergoing a lot of
In early Nauvoo, it was secret.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Toward later Nauvoo period, it became an open secret in Mormon culture. Mm-hmm. And they didn't announce it publicly to non-Mormons until 1852, but it became quite well known.
And that's why the Joseph Smith assassination, I mean, that was a factor in what the law, you know, when the laws came forth with the Nauvoo expositor, a lot of the dynamics for that whole incident with the Nauvoo expositor was decrying the practice of polygamy. It was like Todd says, it was becoming an open secret by June of 1844.
I think your hand was up just barely.
We didn't know about the Fosters as opponents, but I'd be interested of the elites. Were any of them opposed to it? Who stayed in the church? And was any of the opposition at any point based upon the age going down?
Okay, first question, were there people opposed to polygamy who stayed with the church? See, off the top of my head, I can't think of any. You know, you have people like Austin Cowles and William Law and William Marks who were opposed to polygamy, and they kind of ended up in among the Midwest saints, community of RLDS group. Okay, and were people opposed?
Well, I guess further than that, I mean, I've heard apocryphal stories that when some of the other leaders were first told about it, they were repulsed, but they eventually came around. I mean, is there really substance to that? And secondly, was there really any concern or opposition based upon the age of marriage as opposed to the general concept?
Opposition based on the age of marriage.
In other words, but it's okay, but these gals are too young.
I think on a, you know, on an individual basis, there would have been opposition. I know of a couple stories where family members were very upset. I don't think they left the church, but they were upset because church leaders allowed very early marriage. I know a couple of places where, well, the one I'm thinking of, the parents didn't know about the marriage of the plural marriage of their daughters. And so the parents were very upset. I don't think they left the church. In the case of Heber C. Kimball, you know, he was the one who engineered the marriage, the 14-year-old marriage of his daughter. So I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of opposition based on the age of marriage. I think his hand was up first.
Yeah,
Now, how does polyandry fit into this, into the statistics? I mean, roughly a third of Joseph Smith's wives were already married.
Okay, a lot of my statistics are mean age of marriage on first marriage. And so for the polyandrous marriages, none of them was it first marriage. They were already married. It's interesting, isn't it? And so they were not 14, 16. You know, they were more like 20, you know, in their early 20s or mid-20s or late, you know, or even 40s. So that's an interesting question. But I'll have to do the statistical analysis of that now that you've brought it up.
Well, it's probably very difficult to get those statistics because that was not...
Well, in Joseph Smith's family, I could do it pretty easily. Yeah. Yes.
Well, Sidney Rigdon object to Joseph Smith marrying one of his daughters or something?
Yes. Yes.
And that was one... He apostatized.
Teenage
How many
daughter.
Different times? Or was excommunicated? And wasn't that one of the reasons why, right?
He wasn't excommunicated at that time. He wasn't excommunicated. He didn't leave the church until after Brigham Young took over, right? Yeah.
But did he ever?
Obviously, that was a
participator, right? He was never a polygamist, right?
No. Well, actually, wasn't he polygamist?
Like
and later, you know, long after he left the church.
No. He was involved in the formation of two subsequent churches, and neither one of those movements. I mean, there are suggestions that he toyed with polygamy in the first of those movements, and then in the second movement that he was involved with, he was very anti-polygamy. And the one that, when he was involved with Stephen Post, and there was strong opposition to that.
Okay. But obviously, Joseph Smith proposing to Nancy Rigdon without Sidney's permission. That caused
That was
an estrangement between Joseph Smith and Sidney.
They were reconciled.
Is it time to stop? Okay, thanks for your interesting questions.
Thank you.